It's a real head scratcher when you really think about it, this whole idea of right and wrong, what feels absolutely solid, true to one person or one group can be seen as totally out of whack by someone else. It's like we're all carrying around these slightly different moral rule books, and it's this fascinating puzzle, this variation in our moral compasses that some of you have flagged as something you're keen for us to explore.
Absolutely. Yeah, we've had some great sources come in that really dig into this. And today we're going to take a deep dive into a concept that tries to make sense of this moral variety. Ethical relativism?
Ethical
Yeah,
relativism.
the core idea here is that moral values aren't these universal set-in-stone truths that apply to everyone everywhere.
Okay, ethical relativism. So if morality isn't like a fixed point, what exactly is it anchored to then?
Well, ethical relativism isn't just one single idea. It actually has a couple of main branches. The first one is cultural relativism. This basically says that what's considered moral is decided by a specific culture and its long-standing traditions. Then you've got moral subjectivism, which takes it down to a much more personal level, suggesting that morality is really just a matter of individual preferences.
So our mission today is to really get our hands dirty with these two forms of ethical relativism. We want to understand the arguments people make in their favor, but maybe even more importantly, we need to look at some of the potential problems and, where this line of thinking might lead us.
Right.
Ultimately, we're aiming to give you, the listener, a clearer way to think about moral truth in what can often feel like a very morally ambiguous world.
Exactly. And it's worth noting where our primary source for this deep dive comes from. It's excerpts from Dr. James S. Spiegel's Teaching on Christian Ethics, Session 2, which specifically addresses ethical relativism. Interestingly, Spiegel draws quite a bit from James Rachel's influential book, The Elements of Moral Philosophy. Now, what's particularly thought-provoking here is that Rachel's himself was actually an atheist
Oh, interesting.
who was a firm believer in objective moral truth and actually argued against relativism.
That's a fascinating tidbit right there. An atheist making a strong case against the idea that morality is all just, up for grabs.
No.
It definitely challenges some common assumptions.
It really does. And Spiegel points out that the majority of philosophers across different belief systems tend to agree with Rachel's on this, that there is some form of objective moral truth out there. So it seems like relativism isn't exactly the most popular viewpoint in professional philosophy, perhaps surprisingly.
Okay, so it's not the default position for most thinkers.
Right.
So let's get into that first branch then. Cultural relativism. What
Right.
does that actually look like in practice?
Okay. So cultural relativism, as we said, proposes that moral values are essentially products of a specific culture. What a culture considers right or good or acceptable is defined by its own unique set of norms, traditions, and established ways of doing things.
And this idea, as Beagle touches on, it really gained traction back in the early to mid 20th century, largely due to the groundbreaking work of cultural anthropologists.
Yes, exactly. Thinkers like William Graham Sumner and Ruth Benedict really brought to light the incredible diversity of cultural practices we see around the globe. As anthropologists delved deeper into studying different societies, they uncovered some truly remarkable differences in what might seem like fundamental beliefs.
Like what sort of things?
Well, things we often take for granted, like how marriage is structured, how children are treated, even the views on when it's acceptable to take a human life, these vary dramatically from one culture to another.
It really makes you pause and reconsider your own assumptions, doesn't it? When you realize that something you've always considered a given is viewed in a completely different light somewhere else.
Definitely.
So if we try to get down to the core of it, the meta-ethics, as you mentioned, how would someone who believes in cultural relativism define something as good or bad?
Right. So from that standpoint, X is good simply means that X aligns with or is in harmony with the accepted customs and traditions, what are often called the mores of that particular culture. Conversely, X is bad or wrong, just means that it goes against those established ways of behaving within that society.
Spiegel uses some really relatable everyday examples to illustrate this point, doesn't he?
He does.
Like, take burping at the dinner table. In many Western cultures, it's considered quite impolite, right?
Absolutely. But in some other parts of the world, it's actually seen as a compliment to the chef, a sign that you thoroughly enjoyed the meal. It's the same action, but the moral interpretation is completely different depending on the cultural context.
Right. And what about the hitchhiking one?
Oh, yeah, another classic example. The thumbs-up gesture we use in many Western countries to signal, "I need a ride," can be deeply offensive in certain parts of Europe and the Middle East.
Really? How so?
It carries a vulgar sexual connotation there.
Yeah.
So in those cases, whether the action is okay or not is clearly tied to cultural understanding. It's not inherently good or bad in itself.
Right. Okay. So there are definitely behaviors where the relativity is pretty clear cut, things that are just convention.
Exactly.
But the really critical question, the one Spiegel pushes us to consider, is whether all human behavior, all moral considerations are just like burping or hitchhiking. Is it all just a matter of cultural preference, like, you know, whether you prefer tea or coffee?
And this brings us right to the central argument often put forward by cultural relativists, what Rachel's famously called the cultural differences argument.
Okay, the cultural differences argument.
The premise is quite simple. Mm-hmm. Different cultures have different moral codes. We observe this variety. From this observation, the argument then jumps to the conclusion. Therefore, there is no objective truth in morality.
It's that idea that if everyone's moral compass points in a slightly different direction, then there's no single true north. It sounds persuasive on the surface, doesn't it? You know, who are we to judge and all that?
It does sound tolerant initially. But as Spiegel clearly lays out, there's a really significant logical flaw in that leap.
A logical flaw? How?
Well, the mere fact that different cultures hold different beliefs about morality doesn't automatically mean that there isn't an objective truth to be found. Having multiple viewpoints on something doesn't negate the possibility of a single correct answer.
Hmm. Can you give an example of that?
Sure. He uses a really helpful analogy here, looking back at the history of astronomy. Think about the vastly different views people have held throughout history about the Earth's place in the universe. The flat Earth theory, the geocentric model with everything revolving around the Earth.
Right, where Earth is the center.
And then the heliocentric model we now know to be accurate with the Earth revolving around the sun. Now, these views are mutually exclusive. The Earth can't be flat and the sphere orbiting the sun at the same time.
Right, obviously.
And even though throughout history, and remarkably, even today, with the resurgence of flat Earth theories championed by some well-known individuals, people have held very different astronomical beliefs, that doesn't mean there's no objective truth about the structure of our solar system. One of those views aligns with reality, regardless of popular opinion at any given time.
Right. Just because there's disagreement doesn't mean there isn't a right answer. We wouldn't say, well, some people believe the Earth is flat, some believe it's round, so I guess there's no real truth to the matter. We recognize that one of those views corresponds to how things actually are, based on evidence.
Precisely. Now, someone who supports cultural relativism might try to strengthen their argument at this point. They might say, okay, fine, but unlike science, there's no reliable method for determining objective truth in morality.
Okay. So the argument shifts.
Yeah. We have scientific tools, rigorous methods to investigate the physical world. But what comparable tools do we have for ethics? How do we scientifically prove a moral claim?
That's a really interesting challenge to consider, isn't it? How do we empirically demonstrate that something is morally right or wrong in the same way we can demonstrate, say, gravity?
It's a fair question about methodology. But while acknowledging that the ways we uncover truth in science and ethics might be different, Spiegel counters that this still doesn't logically lead to the conclusion that there's no objective moral truth.
Okay, how does he counter that?
He circles back to the astronomy analogy. Think about centuries ago, before the invention of powerful telescopes and sophisticated astronomical tools. People didn't have the same reliable methods for understanding the cosmos as we do today.
Right, their methods were limited.
But the Earth was still revolving around the sun, even if they didn't have the instruments to definitively prove it at that time. The truth existed independently of their ability to measure or directly observe it with precision.
Okay, so the truth was there even without the perfect method to find it yet.
Exactly. And Spiegel argues that we do have reliable ways of approaching and understanding moral truth. He points to the use of reason, our shared human experience, and from a Christian perspective, which is his background, the idea of special revelation found in Scripture.
So things like logic, empathy, historical lessons.
Yes. These provide frameworks for making well-reasoned moral judgments, even if they don't involve the same kind of empirical measurement we see in, say, physics.
So the argument that the lack of a perfect scientific-style method somehow disproves the existence of objective morality doesn't quite hold up, according to Spiegel.
Right. But he also delves into some really significant and, frankly, quite disturbing consequences if we were to actually embrace cultural relativism. This is where the implications get really profound.
Okay, what are these consequences?
Well, one of the most troubling implications is that if cultural relativism is true, it becomes impossible to genuinely criticize the values and practices of other societies, no matter how abhorrent they might seem to us.
Wait, impossible to criticize? Why?
Because if morality is purely defined by a culture's own internal norms, then who are we, with our own set of cultural assumptions, to say that something another culture does is morally wrong? Spiegel brings up the example of Nazi Germany. If cultural relativism were the final word, we couldn't definitively say that the Holocaust was objectively evil.
Because
it was, after all, consistent with the prevailing values and laws of that society at that particular time. If their culture defined it as acceptable or necessary, then on what grounds could we condemn it as universally wrong?
Wow. That's deeply unsettling. It fundamentally undermines our ability to condemn even the most extreme cases of injustice and oppression.
It really does. Another really significant problem is that cultural relativism essentially makes the very idea of moral progress completely meaningless.
Moral progress? How so?
Well, think about it. If there's no objective standard outside of a particular culture to strive towards, how can we ever say that a society has actually improved morally over time?
Ah, I see. So, like, the abolition of slavery or women gaining the right to vote under cultural relativism, those aren't necessarily progress.
Exactly. They're just changes in cultural norms. We can't say they represent a move towards something objectively better or more just, because there's no external better to measure against. Things don't get better, they just get different.
That seems wrong. We generally do think of those as positive moral developments.
Right. The very concept of progress implies a benchmark, a higher standard against which we measure change. Without that external standard, we're just moving from one set of cultural preferences to another.
Okay. Any other consequences?
Yes, and this one's really counterintuitive. Cultural relativism leads to the strange implication that moral reformers throughout history are actually morally corrupt.
Wait a minute. How does that follow? Someone like Martin Luther King Jr., who bravely challenged the deeply ingrained racist laws and attitudes of his time, a moral hero to so many, how could he possibly be considered corrupt under cultural relativism?
Because a moral reformer, by definition, is someone who goes against the prevailing cultural norms and values of their society. If those norms are morality, as cultural relativism claims,
then challenging them means you're acting immorally, according to that culture's standards.
Precisely. But our common moral intuition tells us the exact opposite. We see people like Dr. King's or Gandhi or suffragettes who fought for a more just society as moral leaders and visionaries, not as corrupting influences.
And as Spiegel points out, Dr. King himself didn't just appeal to his own personal feelings or the changing tides of public opinion. He appealed to a higher moral law, right? A standard of justice that transcended the specific flawed laws of his time to justify his actions. He believed in moral absolutes.
He certainly did. So to really bring this home, Spiegel presents what's called a reduction to absurdity argument.
Okay, what's that?
It's basically saying, if cultural relativism is consistently applied, then we are forced to accept these conclusions. That the Nazis weren't absolutely wrong, that moral progress is just an illusion, and that people who fight for moral improvement are actually acting immorally.
And those conclusions, they just seem obviously wrong to most people.
Exactly. They clash so dramatically with our most fundamental moral common sense that it strongly suggests the initial premise, cultural relativism must be flawed somewhere.
It seems like cultural relativism, while perhaps initially sounding tolerant and respectful of different ways of life, ultimately kind of crumbles under closer examination, especially when you consider these really problematic implications.
That's the argument, yes. Yeah. And Spiegel also raises a practical problem with defining culture. Like, what is the boundary? Is it national, regional? What about subcultures within a country?
Oh, yeah, that's a good point. Like, even within the U.S., think about cultural differences between, say, rural Indiana and downtown Austin, Texas, which culture's morality applies. It gets messy.
Very messy. Which actually leads us nicely into the second major form of ethical relativism, moral subjectivism.
Okay, moral subjectivism. How does that differ from what we've been discussing?
Moral subjectivism takes the idea of moral relativity even further, maybe to its logical extreme. It argues that moral values aren't just relative to a particular culture, but they are relative to each individual person's own personal preferences and feelings.
Wow. Okay, so it's not X is good because my culture says so, but X is good because I personally like it. That's a pretty significant shift.
It is. Precisely.
Yeah.
From a meta-ethical standpoint, someone who believes in moral subjectivism would say that the statement X is good simply means I personally like X, and the statement X is bad means I don't like X.
Like taste in food.
Exactly. Spiegel draws that useful parallel. I might say that Brussels sprouts are disgusting and therefore bad because I dislike them intensely, while someone else might say they are delicious and therefore good because they enjoy eating them.
And nobody argues about that usually.
Right. The moral subjectivist argues that moral judgments are fundamentally no different from these kinds of personal taste preferences.
I can see how that might seem straightforward, at least from the individual's point of view. It certainly seems to simplify the process of determining right and wrong for oneself. Okay. You just have to check in with your own feelings and preferences about it.
Seems simple, yes.
Spiegel gives some examples of complex moral issues like euthanasia, war, the death penalty, abortion. Under a purely subjectivist view, the morality of these huge issues just boils down to whether an individual personally likes or dislikes them.
That's the implication. And while that might appear to offer a seemingly easy way for an individual to make moral decisions, it quickly leads to some really profound and troubling problems, maybe even more so than cultural relativism.
Okay, oh, like what? What are the problems with subjectivism?
Well, one of the most significant is that it completely undermines any foundation for the concepts of moral duty, obligation, and rights. Well, if morality is simply about what I personally like or dislike, why should I feel any obligation to do something I don't feel like doing, even if it significantly impacts others in a negative way? Where do fundamental ideas like human rights even come from in that kind of framework?
Yeah, it seems like they just evaporate. If it's all just preference, my rights are just what I prefer, and your rights are what you prefer, and there's no real grounding.
Exactly. There's no external standard or shared value system to ground these essential concepts.
Mm.
Another major issue is that moral subjectivism makes genuine moral disagreement utterly impossible and, frankly, a bit ridiculous.
Impossible. Why? Because we're just stating preferences.
Precisely. Yeah. If my saying abortion is wrong just means I personally don't like abortion, and someone else saying abortion is right just means they personally like abortion, then we're not actually disagreeing about any objective moral fact.
We're just stating our different personal preferences, like the ice cream example you mentioned. One person likes vanilla, another likes chocolate. We're not really arguing about anything factual.
Right. And as Spiegel points out, would we ever have a serious, prolonged debate about whether Brussels sprouts taste good? It seems rather pointless because it's generally understood to be a purely subjective matter of personal taste.
Yeah, that would be weird.
But when we apply that same logic to really serious moral issues like abortion or, say, factory farming, it feels deeply inadequate. Our moral disagreements feel real and important. We believe there's something more at stake than just individual feelings.
Absolutely. We engage in these often passionate debates precisely because we believe there's something more fundamental at stake than just personal opinions. We think there's a right and wrong to be discovered and argued for, not just, you know, a matter of individual preference.
Furthermore, moral subjectivism leads to the really bizarre and honestly disturbing conclusion that we can never absolutely condemn or praise anything.
Never condemn, even like horrific acts.
Think back to those truly horrific examples we touched on. The Nazi Holocaust, the torturing of innocent babies, rape, murder. If morality is ultimately just about individual preference, then if someone, however twisted it sounds, genuinely enjoys these acts, then a consistent moral subjectivist would have to concede that it is, in that moment, right for them. Because right just means I like it.
That's a truly chilling implication. It completely strips away our ability to make universal moral judgments about even the most heinous and universally condemned acts.
It does. And the final, perhaps most glaring problem with moral subjectivism, as Spiegel argues, is that it implies we can never, ever be mistaken about our own moral judgments.
Never mistaken. How does that work?
Well, if right and wrong are solely determined by our current feelings and preferences, then as long as we are honestly aware of what we like or dislike at any given moment, we are by definition always morally correct in our own eyes.
That doesn't feel right. People change their minds about moral issues all the time.
Exactly. This completely contradicts our own lived experience of grappling with moral issues, learning, growing, and sometimes changing our minds quite profoundly.
I know I've certainly changed my views on various moral issues over time, as I think most people have. I might have held one perspective on something years ago, and now, after further reflection or maybe new information or just deeper understanding, I hold a completely different one.
And under moral subjectivism, how do you account for that kind of change or moral growth? Were you wrong according to your feelings at that earlier time, and now you're right based on your current feelings? Subjectivism can't really explain that sense of moral development or correction.
So it implies
what?
Both views were right at the time.
It would imply that both your previous and your current, potentially completely contradictory views, were equally right, simply because they accurately reflected your feelings and preferences at those different points in time. Spiegel gives a stark example of someone being strongly pro-life one day, and then based on a shift in feelings, becoming strongly pro-choice the next day, both positions would have to be considered morally correct according to their feelings on each particular day.
Which feels completely counterintuitive to our understanding of morality. Our intuition tells us that there is a truth to be sought, and that we can be closer to or further away from that truth in our moral understanding.
Right. We think we can be wrong about morality.
So it really seems like moral subjectivism, while perhaps attempting to simplify things down to the individual, ends up creating even more significant and problematic inconsistencies than cultural relativism did.
That's the overarching conclusion presented in the source material, yes. Both forms of ethical relativism, cultural and subjective, while perhaps acknowledging some aspects of the diverse human experience of morality, ultimately fail to provide a satisfactory and coherent framework for understanding right and wrong.
Because they clash with our basic moral intuitions.
They both clash with our deepest moral intuitions and lead to some truly problematic, even arguably absurd consequences when you follow them consistently to their logical conclusions.
Okay. So if this whole idea of moral relativism in both its major forms doesn't really hold water, where do we go from here in our understanding of morality?
Well, if relativism seems to fall short in explaining our fundamental moral intuitions and leads to these significant contradictions, it strongly suggests a need to explore objectivist moral theories.
Objectivist theories?
Meaning, ideas that propose the existence of moral truths that are independent of both cultural trends and individual preferences. The idea is some things are right or wrong, regardless of what any particular culture or individual happens to believe or feel about them.
And that sounds like a fascinating area for future deep dives, exploring what those objectivist theories might look like.
Definitely.
But for now, as you've been listening to this exploration of ethical relativism and its shortcomings, here's a final thought to really consider. Reflect on a time in your own life when your moral views on a significant issue underwent a change. Maybe something big, maybe something smaller. According to the logic of ethical subjectivism, were you somehow wrong before that shift in your thinking, or are you potentially wrong now in your current understanding? What does that personal experience, that feeling of perhaps having been mistaken or having grown morally, tell you about the very nature of morality itself? It's definitely something to really mull over.